Sure enough, Mrs. Hudson came in once again, this time ushering in a man who walked into the room as if he were making an entrance on the London stage. He was formally dressed in a dark tailcoat, wing collar and white bow tie, with a black cloak around his shoulders, waistcoat, gloves and patent leather shoes. In one hand he held a pair of white gloves, and in the other a rosewood walking stick with a silver tip and handle. His dark hair was surprisingly long, sweeping back over a high forehead, and he had neither beard nor moustache. His skin was pale, his face a little too elongated to be truly handsome. His age, I would have said, would have been in the mid-30s, and yet the seriousness of his demeanour, his evident discomfort at finding himself here, made him appear older. He reminded me at once of some of the patients who had consulted me, the ones who had refused to believe they were unwell until their symptoms persuaded them otherwise. They were always the most gravely ill. Our visitor stood before us with equal reluctance. He waited in the doorway, looking anxiously around him, while Mrs. Hudson handed Holmes his card. "Mr. Carstairs," Holmes said, "please take a seat." "You must forgive me arriving in this manner, unexpected and unannounced." He had a clipped, rather dry way of speaking. His eyes still did not quite meet our gaze. "In truth, I had no intention of coming here at all. I live in Wimbledon, close to the Green, and have come into town for the opera. Not that I am in any mood for Wagner. I have just come from my club, where I met with my accountant, a man I have known for many years, and whom I now consider a friend. When I told him of the troubles I have been having, the sense of oppression that is making my life so damnably difficult, he mentioned your name and urged me to consult you. By coincidence, my club is not far from here, and so I resolved to come straight from him to you." "I am happy to give you my full attention," Holmes said. "And this gentleman?" Our visitor turned to me. "Dr. John Watson. He's my closest adviser, and I can assure you that anything you have to say to me can be uttered in his presence." "Very well. My name, as you see, is Edmund Carstairs, and I am, by profession, a dealer in fine art. I have a gallery, Carstairs and Finch, on Albemarle Street, which has been in business now for 6 years. We specialize in the works of the great masters, mainly from the end of last century and the early years of this present one. Gainsborough, Reynolds, Constable, and Turner. Their paintings will be familiar to you, I am sure, and they command the very highest prices. Only this week I sold 2 Van Dyck portraits to a private client for the sum of £25,000. Our business is a successful one, and we have flourished, even with so many new, and I might say inferior, galleries sprouting in all the streets around us. Over the years we have built for ourselves a reputation for sobriety and reliability. Our clients include many members of the aristocracy, and we have seen our works hung in some of the finest mansions in the country. Your partner, Mr. Finch? Tobias Finch is rather older than myself, although we are equal partners. If there is one disagreement between us, it is that he is more cautious and conservative than I. For example, I have a strong interest in some of the new work coming in from the continent. I refer to the painters who have become known as the Impressionists, such artists as Monet and Degas. Only a week ago I was offered a seaside scene by Pissarro, which I thought to be quite delightful and full of colour. My partner, alas, took the opposite view. He insists that such works are little more than a blur, and although it is indeed the case that some of the shapes are indistinguishable at short range, I cannot persuade him that he is missing the point. However, I will not tire you gentlemen with a lecture on art. We are a traditional gallery, and that, for now, is what we shall remain." Holmes nodded. "Pray continue." "Mr. Holmes, 2 weeks ago, I realized that I was being watched. Ridgeway Hall, which is the name of my home, stands on one side of a narrow lane, with a cluster of almshouses some distance away at the end. These are our closest neighbours. We are surrounded by common land, and from my dressing room I have a view of the village green. It was here, on a Tuesday morning, that I became aware of a man standing with his legs apart and his arms folded, and I was struck at once by his extraordinary stillness. He was too far away from me to be able to see him clearly, but I would have said that he was a foreigner. He was wearing a long frock coat with padded shoulders of a cut that was most certainly not English. Indeed, I was in America last year, and if I were to guess, I would say it was from this country that he had originated. What struck me most forcefully, however, for reasons that I will shortly explain, was that he was also wearing a hat, a flat cap of the sort that is sometimes called a cheese cutter. It was this, and the way that he stood there, that first attracted my attention, and so unnerved me. If he had been a scarecrow, I swear he could not have been more static. There was a light rain falling, swept by the breeze across the common, but he didn't seem to notice it. His eyes were fixed on my window. I can tell you that they were very dark, and that they seemed to be boring into me. I gazed at him for at least a minute, perhaps longer, then went down to breakfast. However, before I ate, I sent the scullery boy out to see if the man was still there. He was not. The boy reported back that the green was empty. "A singular occurrence," Holmes remarked. "But Ridgeway Hall is, I am sure, a fine building, and a visitor to this country might well have found it merited his examination." "And so I told myself. But a few days later, I saw him a second time. On this occasion, I was in London. My wife and I had just come out of the theatre. We'd been to the Savoy. And there he was, on the other side of the road, wearing the same coat, again with a flat cap. I might not have noticed him, Mr. Holmes, but as before, he was unmoving, and with the crowds passing round on either side of him. He could have been a solid rock in a fast-flowing river. I'm afraid I was unable to see him clearly, however, for although he had chosen the position in the full glow of a street lamp, it had thrown a shadow across his face and acted like a veil. Though perhaps that was his intent. But you were sure it was the same man? There could be no doubt of it. Did your wife see him? No, and I did not wish to alarm her by making any mention of it. We had a hansom waiting and we left at once. This is most interesting, Holmes remarked. The behaviour of this man makes no sense at all. He stands in the middle of a village green and beneath a street lamp. On the one hand, it's as if he's making every effort to be seen, and yet he makes no attempt to approach you. He did approach me, Carstairs replied. The very next day, in fact, when I returned early to the house. My friend Finch was in the gallery, cataloguing a collection of drawings and etchings by Samuel Scott. He had no need of me, and I was still uneasy after the two sightings. I arrived back at Ridgeway Hall shortly before 3 o'clock, and it was just as well that I did, for there was the rogue approaching my front door. I called out to him, and he turned and saw me. At once he began to run towards me, and I was sure that he was about to strike me and even lifted my walking stick to protect myself. But his mission was not one of violence. He came straight up to me, and for the first time I saw his face. Thin lips, dark brown eyes, and a livid scar on his right cheek, the result of a recent bullet wound. He had been drinking spirits. I could smell them on his breath. He didn't utter a word to me, but instead lifted a note into the air and pressed it into my hand. Then, before I could stop him, he ran off. "And the note?" Holmes asked. "I have it here." The art dealer produced a square of paper, folded into four, and handed it to Holmes. Holmes opened it carefully. "My glass, if you please, Watson." As I handed him the magnifying glass, he turned to Carstairs. "There was no envelope?" "No." "I find that of the greatest significance, but let us see." There were just 6 words written in block capitals on the page. "St. Mary's Church, tomorrow, midday." "The paper is English," Holmes remarked, "even if the visitor was not. You notice that he writes in capitals, Watson. What do you suggest his purpose might be?" "To disguise his handwriting," I said. "It is possible. although since the man had never written to Mr. Carstairs, and is perhaps unlikely to write to him again, you would have thought his handwriting would have been of no consequence. Was the message folded when it was handed to you, Mr. Carstairs? No, I think not. I folded it myself later. The picture becomes clearer by the minute. This church that he refers to, St. Mary's, I assume it is in Wimbledon? It is on Hothouse Lane, Carstairs replied. Just a few minutes' walk from my home. This behaviour is also lacking in logic, do you not think? The man wishes to speak with you. He places a message to that effect in your hand, but he does not speak. He does not utter a word.